The 12th lesson, Subconscious Influences. In this lesson, we wish to touch upon a certain feature of subconscious mentation that has been much dwelt upon by certain schools of Western writers and students during the past 20 years, but which has also been misunderstood and, alas, too often misused by some of those who have been attracted to the subject. We allude to what has been called the power of thought. While this power is very real, and like any other of the forces of nature, may be properly used and applied in our everyday life, still many students of the power of mind have misused it, and have stooped to practices worthy only of the followers of the schools of black magic. We hear on all sides of the use of treatments for selfish and often base ends, those following these practices seeming to be in utter ignorance of the occult laws brought into operation, and the terrible reaction inevitably falling to the lot of those practicing this negative form of mental influence. We have been amazed at the prevailing ignorance concerning the nature and effects of this improper use of mental force, and at the same time at the common custom of such selfish, improper uses. This, more particularly, when the true occultist knows that these things are not necessary, even to those who seek success by mental forces. There is a true method of the use of mental forces, as well as an improper use, and we trust that in this lesson we may be able to bring the matter sharply and clearly before the minds of our students. In our first course, the 14 lessons, in the several lessons entitled respectively Thought Dynamics, Telepathy, etc., and Psychic Influence, we have given a general idea of the effect of one mind upon other minds, and many other writers have called the attention of the Western world to the same facts. There has been a general awakening of interest in this phase of the subject among the Western people of late years, and many and wonderful are the theories that have been advanced among the conflicting schools regarding the matter. But notwithstanding the conflicting theories, there is a general agreement upon the fundamental facts. They all agree that the mental forces may be used to affect oneself and others, and many have started in to use these mental forces for their own selfish ends and purposes, believing that they were fully justified in so doing, and being unaware of the web of psychic causes and effects which they were weaving around them by their practices. Now, at the beginning, let us impress upon the minds of our students the fact that while it is undoubtedly true that people who are unaware of the true sources of strength within them may be and often are affected by mental force exerted by others, it is equally true that no one can be adversely affected in this way, providing he realizes the I within himself, which is the only real part of him, and which is an impregnable tower of strength against the assaults of others. There is no cause for all of this fear that is being manifested by many Western students of thought power, who are in constant dread of being treated adversely by other people. The man or woman who realizes the I within may, by the slightest exercise of the will, surround himself with a mental aura which will repel adverse thought waves emanating from the minds of others. Nay, more than this, the habitual recognition of the I, and a few moments' meditation upon it each day, will of itself erect such an aura, and will charge this aura with a vitality that will turn back adverse thought, and cause it to return to the source from which it came, where it will serve the good purpose of bringing to the mistaken mind originating it the conviction that such practices are hurtful and to be avoided. This realization of the I, which we brought out in the first few lessons of the present series, is the best and only real method of self-protection. This may be easily understood when we remind you that the whole phenomena of mental influencing belongs to the illusion side of existence, the negative side, and that the real and positive side must of necessity be stronger. Nothing can affect the real in you, and the nearer you get to the real, in realization and understanding, the stronger do you become. This is the whole secret. Think it over. But there are comparatively few people who are able to rest firmly in the I consciousness all the time, and the others demand help while they are growing. To such, we would say, creep as close to the realization of the I as possible, and rest your spiritual feet firmly upon the rock of the real self. If you feel that people, circumstances, or things are influencing you unduly, stand up boldly and deny the influence. Say something like this: I deny the power of or influence of persons, circumstances, or things to adversely affect me. I assert my reality, power, and dominion over these things. These words may seem very simple, but when uttered with a consciousness of the truth underlying them, they become as a mighty force. You will understand, of course, that there is no magic or virtue in the words themselves, that is, in the grouping of the letters forming the words or the sounds of the words, the virtue resting in the idea of which the words are the expression. You will be surprised at the effect of this statement upon depressing or adverse influences surrounding you. If you who are reading these words now, feel yourself subject to any adverse or depressing influences, will then stand up erect, throwing your shoulders back, raising your head, and looking boldly and fearlessly ahead, and repeat these words firmly and with faith, you will feel the adverse influences disappearing. You will almost see the cloud falling back from you. Try it now before reading further, and you will become conscious of a new strength and power. You are perfectly justified in thus denying adverse influence. You have a perfect right to drive back threatening or depressing thought clouds. You have a perfect right to take your stand upon the rock of truth, your real self, and demand your freedom. These negative thoughts of the world in general, and of some people in particular, belong to the dark side of life, and you have a right to demand freedom from them. You do not belong to the same side of life, and it is your privilege, yes, your duty, to repel them and bid them disappear from your horizon. You are a child of light, and it is your right and duty to assert your freedom from the things of darkness. You are merely asserting the truth when you affirm your superiority and dominion over these dark forces. And in the measure of your recognition and faith will be the power at your disposal. Faith and recognition renders man a god. If we could but fully recognize and realize just what we are, we could rise above this entire plane of negative, dark world of thought. But we have become so blinded and stupefied with the race thought of fear and weakness, and so hypnotized with the suggestions of weakness that we hear on all sides of us, that even the best of us find it hard to avoid occasionally sinking back into the lower depths of despair and discouragement. But let us remember this, brothers and sisters, that these periods of backsliding become less frequent and last a shorter time as we proceed. By and by, we shall escape them altogether. Some may think that we are laying too much stress upon the negative side of the question, but we feel that what we have said is timely and much needed by many who read these lessons. There has been so much said regarding this negative, adverse power of thought that it is well that all should be taught that it is in their power to rise above this thing, that the weapon for its defeat is already in their hands. The most advanced student may occasionally forget that he is superior to the adverse influence of the race thought and other clouds of thought influence that happen to be in his neighborhood. When we think of how few there are who are sending forth the positive, hopeful thought waves, and how many are sending forth continually the thoughts of discouragement, fear, and despair, it is no wonder that at times there comes to us a feeling of discouragement, helplessness, and what's the use? But we must be ever alert to stand up and deny these things out of existence so far as our personal thought world is concerned. There is a wonderful occult truth in the last sentence. We are the makers, preservers, and destroyers of our personal thought world. We may bring into it that which we desire to appear. We may keep there what we wish, cultivating, developing, and unfolding the thought forms that we desire. We may destroy that which we wish to keep out. The I is the master of its thought world. Think over this great truth, O student. By desire, we call into existence. By affirmation, we preserve and encourage. By denial, we destroy. The Hindus, in their popular religious conceptions, picture the One Being as a trinity composed of Brahma, the creator, Vishnu, the preserver, and Shiva, the destroyer. Not three gods, as is commonly supposed, but a trinity composed of three aspects of deity or being. This idea of the threefold being is also applicable to the individual, as above, so below. The I is the being of the individual, and the thought world is its manifestation. It creates, preserves, and destroys as it will. Carry this idea with you and realize that your individual thought world is your own field of manifestation. In it, you are constantly creating, constantly preserving, constantly destroying. And if you can destroy anything in your own thought world, you remove it from its field of activity so far as you are concerned. And if you create anything in your own thought world, you bring it into active being so far as you are concerned. And if you preserve anything, you keep it by you in effect and full operation and influence in your life. This truth belongs to the higher phases of the subject, for its explanation is inextricably bound up in the explanation of the thing in itself, the absolute and its manifestations. But even what we have said above should give to the alert student sufficient notice to cause him to grasp the facts of the case and to apply the principles in his own life. If one lives on the plane of the race thought, he is subject to its laws, for the law of cause and effect is in full operation on each plan of life. But when one raises himself above the race thought and onto the plane of the recognition of the real self, the I, then does he extricate himself from the lower laws of cause and effect and places himself on a higher plane of causation in which he plays a much higher part. And so we are constantly reminding you that your tower of strength and refuge lies on the higher plane. But nevertheless, we must deal with the things and laws of the lower plane, because very few who read these lessons are able to rest entirely upon the higher plane. The great majority of them have done no more than to lift themselves partially onto the higher plane, and they are consequently living on both planes, partly in each, the consequence being that there is a struggle between the conflicting laws of the two planes. The present stage is one of the hardest on the path of attainment and resembles the birth pains of the physical body. But you are being born into a higher plane, and the pain after becoming the most acute will begin to ease, and in the end will disappear, and then will come peace and calm. When the pain becomes the most acute, then be cheered with the certainty that you have reached the crisis of your new spiritual birth, and that you will soon gain peace. And then you will see that the peace and bliss will be worth all the pain and struggle. Be brave, fellow followers of the path. Deliverance is nigh. Soon will come the silence that follows the storm. The pain that you are experiencing, ah, well do we know that you are experiencing the pain, is not punishment, but is a necessary part of your growth. All life follows this plan. The pains of labor and birth ever precede the deliverance. Such is life, and life is based upon truth, and all is well with this world. We did not intend to speak of these things in this lesson, but as we write, there comes to us a great cry for help and a word of encouragement and hope from the class which is taking this course of lessons, and we feel bound to respond as we have done. Peace be with you, one and all. And now we will begin our consideration of the laws governing what we have called subconscious influence. All students of the occult are aware of the fact that men may be and are largely influenced by the thoughts of others. Not only is this the case in instances where thoughts are directed from the mind of one person to the mind of another, but also when there is no special direction or intention in the thoughts sent forth. The vibrations of thought linger in the astral atmosphere long after the effort that sent forth the thought has passed. The astral atmosphere is charged with the vibrations of thinkers of many years past and still possesses sufficient vitality to affect those whose minds are ready to receive them at this time. And we all attract to us thought vibrations corresponding in nature with those which we are in the habit of entertaining. The law of attraction is in full operation, and one who makes a study of the subject may see instances of it on all sides. We invite to ourselves these thought vibrations by maintaining and entertaining thoughts along certain lines. If we cultivate a habit of thinking along the lines of cheerfulness, brightness, and optimism, we attract to ourselves similar thought vibrations of others, and we will find that before long, we will find all sorts of cheerful thoughts pouring into our minds from all directions. And likewise, if we harbor thoughts of gloom, despair, pessimism, we lay ourselves open to the influx of similar thoughts which have emanated from the minds of others. Thoughts of anger, hate, or jealousy attract similar thoughts which serve to feed the flame and keep alive the fire of these low emotions. Thoughts of love tend to draw to ourselves the loving thoughts of others, which tend to fill us with a glow of loving emotion. And not only are we affected in this way by the thoughts of others, but what is known as suggestion also plays an important part in this matter of subconscious influence. We find that the mind has a tendency to reproduce the emotions, moods, shades of thought, and feelings of other persons, as evidenced by their attitude, appearance, facial expression, or words. If we associate with persons of a gloomy temperament, we run the risk of catching their mental trouble by the law of suggestion, unless we understand this law and counteract it. In the same way, we find that cheerfulness is contagious, and if we keep in the company of cheerful people, we are very apt to take on their mental quality. The same rule applies to frequenting the company of unsuccessful or successful people, as the case may be. If we allow ourselves to take up the suggestions constantly emanating from them, we will find that our minds will begin to reproduce the tones, attitudes, characteristics, dispositions, and traits of the other persons, and before long we will be living on the same mental plane. As we have repeatedly said, these things are true only when we allow ourselves to take on the impressions. But unless one has mastered the law of suggestion and understands its principles and operations, he is more or less apt to be affected by it. All of you readily recall the effect of certain persons upon others with whom they come in contact. One has a faculty of inspiring with vigor and energy those in whose company he happens to be. Another depresses those around him and is avoided as a human wet blanket. Another will cause a feeling of uneasiness in those around him by reason of his prevailing attitude of distrust, suspicion, and low cunning. Some carry an atmosphere of health around them, while others seem to be surrounded with a sickly aura of disease, even when their physical condition does not seem to indicate the lack of health. Mental states have a subtle way of impressing themselves upon us, and the student who will take the trouble to closely observe those with whom he comes in contact will receive a liberal education along these lines. There is, of course, a great difference in the degree of suggestibility among different persons. There are those who are almost immune, while at the other end of the line are to be found others who are so constantly and strongly impressed by the suggestions of others, conscious or unconscious, that they may be said to scarcely have any independent thought or will of their own. But nearly all persons are suggestible to a greater or lesser degree. It must not be supposed from what we have said that all suggestions are bad, harmful, or undesirable. Many suggestions are very good for us, and coming at the right time have aided us much. But nevertheless, it is well to always let your own mind pass upon these suggestions before allowing them to manifest in your subconscious mind. Let the final decision be your own, not the will of another, although you may have considered outside suggestions in connection with the matter. Remember always that you are an individual, having a mind and will of your own. Rest firmly upon the base of your I consciousness, and you will find yourself able to manifest a wonderful strength against the adverse suggestions of others. Be your own suggestor. Train and influence your subconscious mind yourself, and do not allow it to be tampered with by the suggestions of others. Grow the sense of individuality. There has been much written of recent years in the Western world regarding the effect of mental attitude upon success and attainment upon the material plane. While much of this is nothing but the wildest imagining, still there remains a very firm and solid substratum of truth underlying it all. It is undoubtedly true that one's prevailing mental attitude is constantly manifesting and objectifying itself in his life. Things, circumstances, people, plans, all seem to fit into the general ideal of the strong mental attitude of a man. And this from the operation of mental law along a number of lines of action. In the first place, the mind, when directed toward a certain set of objects, becomes very alert to discover things concerning these objects, to seize upon things, opportunities, persons, ideas, and facts, tending to promote the objects thought of. The man who is looking for facts to prove certain theories invariably finds them, and is also quite likely to overlook facts tending to disprove his theory. The optimist and the pessimist, passing along the same streets, each sees thousands of examples tending to fit in with his idea. As Kay says, when one is engaged in seeking for a thing, if he keep the image of it clearly before the mind, he will be very likely to find it. And that too, probably, where it would otherwise have escaped his notice. So when one is engaged in thinking on a subject, thoughts of things resembling it, or bearing upon it, and tending to illustrate it, come up on every side. Truly we may well say of the mind, as has been said of the eye, that it perceives only what it brings within the power of perceiving. John Burroughs has well said regarding this that no one ever found the walking fern who did not have the walking fern in his mind. A person whose eye is full of Indian relics picks them up in every field he walks through. They are quickly recognized because the eye has been commissioned to find them. When the mind is kept firmly fixed upon some ideal or aim, its whole and varied powers are bent toward the realization and manifestation of that ideal. In thousands of ways, the mind will operate to objectify the subjective mental attitude, a great proportion of the mental effort being accomplished along subconscious lines. It is of the greatest importance to one who wishes to succeed in any undertaking to keep before his mind's eye a clear mental image of that which he desires. He should picture the thing desired, and himself as securing it, until it becomes almost real. In this way, he calls to his aid his entire mental force and power along the subconscious lines, and as it were, makes a clear path over which he may walk to accomplishment. Bain says, regarding this, by aiming at a new construction, we must clearly conceive what is aimed at. Where we have a very distinct and intelligible model before us, we are in a fair way to succeed. In proportion as the ideal is dim and wavering, we stagger or miscarry. Maudsley says, we cannot do an act voluntarily unless we know what we are going to do. And we cannot know exactly what we are going to do until we have taught ourselves to do it. Carpenter says, the continued concentration of attention upon a certain idea gives it a dominant power, not only over the mind, but over the body. Muller says, the idea of our own strength gives strength to our movements. A person who is confident of effecting anything by muscular efforts will do it more easily than one not so confident of his own power. Tanner says, to believe firmly is almost tantamount in the end to accomplishment. Extraordinary instances are related showing the influence of the will over even the involuntary muscles. Along the same lines, many Western writers have added their testimony to the yogi principle of the manifestation of thought into action. Kay has written, a clear and accurate idea of what we wish to do and how it is to be effected is of the utmost value and importance in all the affairs of life. A man's conduct naturally shapes itself according to the ideas in his mind. And nothing contributes more to success in life than having a high ideal and keeping it constantly in view. Where such is the case, one can hardly fail in attaining it. Numerous unexpected circumstances will be found to conspire to bring it about, and even what seemed at first to be hostile may be converted into means for its furtherance, while by having it constantly before the mind, he will be ever ready to take advantage of any favoring circumstances that may present themselves. Along the same lines, Foster has written these remarkable words. It is wonderful how even the casualties of life seem to bow to a spirit that will not bow to them, and yield to subserve a design which they may, in their first apparent tendency, threaten to frustrate. When a firm, decisive spirit is recognized, it is curious to see how the space clears around a man and leaves him room and freedom. Simpson has said, a passionate desire and an unwearied will can perform impossibilities, or what seems to be such, to the cold and feeble. And Maudsley gives to aspiring youth a great truth when he says, thus it is that aspirations are often prophecies, the harbingers of what a man shall be in a condition to perform. And we may conclude the paragraph by quoting Lytton, dream, O youth, dream manfully and nobly, and thy dreams shall be prophets. This principle of the power of the mental image is strongly impressed upon the mind of the chela, or student, by the yogi teachers. The student is taught that just as the house is erected in accordance with the plan of the architect, so is one's life built in accordance with the prevailing mental image. The mind subconsciously molds itself around the prevailing mental image or attitude, and then proceeds to draw upon the outer world for material with which to build in accordance with the plan. Not only is one's character built in this way, but the circumstances and incidents of his life follow the same rule. The yogi student is instructed into the mysteries of the power of the mind in this direction, not that he may make use of it to build up material success or to realize his personal desires, for he is taught to avoid these things, but he is fully instructed nevertheless that he may understand the workings of the law around him. And it is a well-known fact to close students of the occult that the few who have attained extraordinarily high degrees of development make use of this power in order to help the race. Many a world movement has been directed by the mind or minds of some of these advanced souls who were able to see the ideal of evolution ahead of the race, and by visualizing the same and concentrating upon it in meditation, actually hastened the progress of the evolutionary wave and caused to actually manifest that which they saw and upon which they had meditated. It is true that some occultists have used similar plans to further their own selfish personal ends, often without fully realizing just what power they were employing, but this merely illustrates the old fact that the forces of nature may be used rightly and wrongly. And it is all the more reason why those who are desirous of advancing the race, of assisting in the evolution of the world, should make use of this mighty power in their work. Success is not reprehensible, notwithstanding the fact that many have interpreted and applied the word in such a manner as to make it appear as if it had no other meaning or application other than the crude, material, selfish one generally attributed to it by reason of its misuse. The Western world is playing its part in the evolution of the race, and its keynote is accomplishment. Those who have advanced so high that they are able to view the world of men as one sees a valley from a mountain peak recognize what this strenuous Western life means. They see mighty forces in operation, mighty principles being worked out by those who little dream of the ultimate significance of that which they are doing. Mighty things are before the Western world today. Wonderful changes are going on. Great things are in the womb of time, and the hour of birth draws near. The men and women in the Western world feel within them the mighty urge to accomplish something, to take an active part in the great drama of life. And they are right in giving full expression to this urge, and are doing well in using every legitimate means in the line of expression. And this idea of the mental attitude, or the mental image, is one of the greatest factors in this striving for success. In this lesson, we do not propose giving success talks for our students. These lessons are intended to fill another field, and there are many other channels of information along the lines named. What we wish to do is to point out to our students the meaning of all this strenuous striving of the age in the Western world and the leading principle employed therein. The great achievements of the material world are being accomplished by means of the power of the mind. Men are beginning to understand that thought manifests itself in action, and that thought attracts to itself the things, persons, and circumstances in harmony with itself. The power of mind is becoming manifest in hundreds of ways. The power of desire, backed by faith and will, is beginning to be recognized as one of the greatest of known dynamic forces. The life of the race is entering into a new and strange stage of development and evolution, and in the years to come, mind will be seen more clearly and still more clearly to be the great principle underlying the world of material things and happenings. That all is mind is more than a dreamy metaphysical utterance, is being recognized by the leaders in the world's thought. As we have said, great changes are before the world and the race, and every year brings us nearer to the beginning of them. In fact, the beginning is already upon us. Let any thinker stop and reflect over the wonderful changes of the past 6 years, since the dawning of the 20th century, and he will be dull indeed if he does not see the trend of affairs. We are entering into a new great cycle of the race, and the old is being prepared for being dropped off like an old worn-out husk. Old conventions, ideals, customs, laws, ethics, and things sociological, economical, theological, philosophical, and metaphysical have been outgrown and are about to be shed by the race. The great cauldron of human thought is bubbling away fiercely, and many things are rising to its surface. Like all great changes, the good will come only with much pain. All birth is with pain. The race feels the pain and perpetual unrest, but knows not what is the disease nor the remedy. Many false cases of diagnosis and prescription are even now noticeable, and will become still more in evidence as the years roll by. Many self-styled saviors of the race, prescribers for the pain of the soul and mind, will arise and fall. But out of it all will come that for which the race now waits. The changes that are before us are as great as the changes in thought and life described in the late novel by H.G. Wells, entitled In the Days of the Comet. In fact, Mr. Wells has indicated in that story some of the very changes that the advanced souls of the race have informed their students are before the race. The prophetic insight of the writer named seems marvelous, until one realizes that even that writer is being used as a part of the mental machinery of the change itself. But the change will not come about by reason of the new gas caused by the brushing of the Earth's surface by a passing comet. It will come from the unfolding of the race mind, the process being now underway. Are not the signs of mental unrest and discomfort becoming more and more apparent as the days go by? The pain is growing greater, and the race is beginning to fret and chafe and moan. It knows not what it wants, but it knows that it feels pain and wants something to relieve that pain. The old things are beginning to totter and fall, and ideas rendered sacred by years of observance are being brushed aside with a startling display of irreverence. Under the surface of our civilization, we may hear the straining and groaning of the ideas and principles that are striving to force their way out onto the plane of manifestation. Men are running hither and thither, crying for a leader and a savior. They are trying this thing and that thing, but they find not that which they seek. They cry for satisfaction, but it eludes them. And yet, all this search and disappointment is part of the great change, and is preparing the race for that which must come. And yet the relief will not come from any thing or things. It will come from within. Just as when, in Wells' story, things righted themselves when the vapor of the comet had cleared men's minds, so will things take their new places when the mind of the race becomes cleared by the new unfoldment that is even now underway. Men are beginning to feel each other's pains. They find themselves unsatisfied by the old rule of every man for himself and the devil take the hindmost. It used to content the successful, but now it doesn't seem so satisfying. The man on top is becoming lonesome and dissatisfied and discontented. His success seems to appall him in some mysterious manner, and the man underneath feels stirring within himself strange longings and desires and dissatisfaction. And new frictions are arising, and new and startling ideas are being suddenly advanced, supported, and opposed. And the relations between people seem to be unsatisfactory. The old rules, laws, and bonds are proving irksome. New, strange, and wild thoughts are coming into the minds of people, which they dare not utter to their friends. And yet these same friends are finding similar ideas within themselves. And somehow, underneath it all, is to be found a certain honesty. Yes, there is where the trouble seems to come. The world is tiring of hypocrisy and dishonesty in all human relations, and is crying aloud to be led back, some way, to truth and honesty in thought and action. But it does not see the way out. And it will not see the way out until the race mind unfolds still further. And the pain of the new unfoldment is stirring the race to its depths. From the deep recesses of the race mind are rising to the surface old passions, relics from the cave dweller days and all sorts of ugly mental relics of the past. And they will continue to rise and show themselves until at last the bubbling pot will begin to quiet down. And then will come a new peace, and the best will come to the surface, the essence of all the experiences of the race. To our students, we would say, during the struggle ahead of the race, play well your part, doing the best you can, living each day by itself, meeting each new phase of life with confidence and courage. Be not deluded by appearances, nor follow after strange prophets. Let the evolutionary processes work themselves out, and do you fall in with the wave without struggling and without overmuch striving. The law is working itself out well. Of that be assured. Those who have entered into even a partial understanding and recognition of the one life underlying will find that they will be as the chosen people during the changes that are coming to the race. They have attained that which the race is reaching toward in pain and travail, and the force behind the law will carry them along, for they will be the leaven that is to lighten the great mass of the race in the new dispensation. Not by deed or by action, but by thought will these people leaven the mass. The thought is even now at work, and all who read these words are playing a part in the work, although they may know it not. If the race could realize this truth of the one life underlying today, the change would occur in a moment, but it will not come in that way. When this understanding gradually dawns upon the race, this new consciousness, then will things take their proper places, and the lion and the lamb lie down together in peace. We have thought it well to say these things in this, the last lesson of this course. They are needed words. They will serve to point out the way to those who are able to read. Watch and wait for the silence that will follow the storm. In this series of lessons, we have endeavored to give you a plain, practical presentation of some of the more important features of Raja Yoga. But this phase of the subject, as important and interesting as it is not the highest phase of the great yoga teachings. It is merely the preparation of the soil of the mind for what comes afterward. The phase called Jnana Yoga, the yoga of wisdom, is the highest of all the various phases of yoga, although each of the lower steps is important in itself. We find ourselves approaching the phase of our work for which we have long wished. Those who have advised and directed this work have counseled us to deal with the less advanced and simpler phases in order to prepare the minds of those who might be interested so that they would be ready for the higher teachings. At times we have felt an impatience for the coming of the day when we would be able to teach the highest that has come to us. And now the time seems to have come. Following this course, we will begin a series of lessons in Jnana Yoga, the Yoga of Wisdom, in which we will pass on to our students the highest teachings regarding the reality and its manifestations, the one and the many. The teachings that all is mind will be explained in such a manner as to be understood by all who have followed us so far. We will be able to impart to you the higher truths about spiritual evolution, sometimes called reincarnation, as well as spiritual cause and effect, often called karma. The highest truths about these important subjects are often obscured by popular misconceptions occasioned by partial teaching. We trust that you, our students, will wish to follow us still higher, higher than we have ventured so far. And we assure you that there is a truth to be seen and known that is as much higher than the other phases upon which we have touched, as those phases have been higher than the current beliefs of the masses of the race. We trust that the powers of knowledge may guide and direct us, that we may be able to convey our message so that it may be accepted and understood. We thank our students who have traveled thus far with us, and we assure them that their loving sympathy has ever been a help and an inspiration to us. Peace be with you.